The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. Visit emsmanager.net for a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software.
Listeners, so glad to be back in your ears or your earbuds or however you might be listening to us. This is Greg Fries. You've probably just finished listening to a whole passel of episodes from EMS World Expo. Boy, I just had a blast in Las Vegas with my pals in the ProMed Network podcasting studio that was sponsored by Physiocontrol. It was so nice to have their support. I just had great fun with other podcasters and then other bloggers. Our friends at Zoll put on the Zoll Blogger Bash. It was the fifth year running. That was also great fun as well. And I've been thinking EMS World Expo for the whole 5 days I've been home. Rob, you didn't have a chance to go to EMS World Expo, but what have you been up to?
About 5'9". You're supposed to say I didn't realize they piled it that high, but, just teaching. At the start of the school year, we're into week three right now, so, I have conference envy.
Conference envy. Well, you know, yeah. Whenever you say something in, English units, I immediately think I've got to convert it to the metric system, because you're talking to me from Canada, but I appreciate your, speaking our language.
Well, I try to blend in.
Good. Well, you're doing a great job of it so far, as long as you leave the, what would be the Labatt's and the Molson, behind, you'll fit right in here.
So, Greg, are there any particular speakers that really stood out at that conference?
Well, that's a great question. Sometimes I'm challenged to make it to very many sessions, just because of my other commitments with CenterLearn and, of course, speaking myself and then the podcasting. I did attend the all-day World Trauma Symposium. It was the second annual of that. It was an all-day event put on by NAEMT, PHCLS, and EMS World Expo, and they had a couple things made it neat was that the longest any session or speaker had was 30 minutes. They did several panel discussions that took question and answer from the audience. And, the focus was, the sort of lessons from the battlefield. I think, tragically and unfortunately, we've had maybe too much learning experience, because of dead and wounded soldiers, but I guess on the plus side, we're able to see what of that we might bring into civilian EMS. So that was the big focus of the day.
Were those abstract presentations or kind of TED Talks?
They were more, here's what the research is telling us about tourniquets and different dressings that enhance clotting. One of the presentations was about the, a flight service in Minnesota that's now carrying blood products and fresh frozen plasma. Sometimes the terminology got a little bit higher than I could keep up with. And then there was also a presentation from one of the medical directors of Boston EMS about the Marathon bombing, which was great interest to me.
What was that speaker like?
So he was fantastic. I think he was fantastic. I'm a bit biased in that I'm a marathon runner and I was in Boston, and any conversation about the marathon and, the bombings that day is I'm instantly on the edge of my seat as I still sort of, process and work through my own experience. There was also another presentation from a physician who was part of the Connecticut trauma system, a surgeon, and he talked about the mass shooting at the elementary school in Connecticut last December. And so it was sort of that mostly penetrating trauma. I think one of the things that really stuck with me actually was they also had a physician from Austria who just sort of talked about trauma care in Austria. And, he's also worked here in the States and in Georgia. And he talked about how penetrating trauma is a particularly unique phenomenon to the United States.
It is.
Compared to, especially, Central Western Europe, where they just don't have the same level of gun violence and self-inflicted gun injury, that we have here. And, I thought that was particularly interesting.
That's true.
Point I would say that he brought up.
Parts of Africa might be the only other place where you see that much penetrative trauma, but Canada is the same as Europe. The vast majority of trauma we see is blunt trauma, not penetrating.
Yeah. And, there's also I'm going to talk about it for my endorsement at the end, but, Ben Gilmore premiered a movie and a book, and I had a chance to talk to him, and he mentioned, you know, paramedics, if you want to see a penetrating trauma, he suggested that South Africa and Johannesburg is the place to go, that he had spent some time there. And, he indicated to us that a lot of Australian paramedics, that want to, cut their teeth and improve their trauma care skills are spending time in South Africa.
I've heard that too.
So we've lost Bill. I'll attempt to bring him back into the call here, but we are really pleased to have Mike O'Keefe on the line. Mike, welcome to the EMS Educast.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, we're glad to have you, and it's sort of a circuitous route that you got here. You completed a CenterLearn CE course and wrote some feedback to me in the course evaluation, and it was very detailed, very specific, and I thought, you know, I better find out who this guy is, because he sure knows a lot about this topic, and, you know, I don't want to look like a dope when I reply to him, so I found you using Google, and then I thought, gosh, this would be a perfect person to have on the EMS Educast. So tell us what it is, the work that you do in Vermont. But actually, before you get there, tell us about your background in EMS. How'd you get involved? What was your education? Where have you worked? That type of thing.
Sure. I started actually when I was in college at St. Michael's College here in Vermont. And they have an ambulance service that serves several communities outside of the campus. So I became an EMT and what then was called an EMT intermediate. And then sometime after I left St. Mike's, I started teaching EMT courses, doing that part-time, and also working part-time at the Vermont Poison Center. So I really got to learn a lot about pharmacology from a practical perspective. I did that for a number of years, and one particularly striking incident during that time was in 1984. On July 7th, we had torrential rains, and you've seen some of the flooding recently in Vermont. This was very similar to that, but it was in this area of the state, in Williston, and the Amtrak Montrealer was coming north with about 300 people on board when it derailed because some beavers had been very, very good at building their dams, and they held back the water that had built up until what the National Transportation Safety Board said was a wall of water hit the ground that was under the tracks and washed it all away for a length of 20 feet and a height of 20 feet. So there's nothing under the tracks there. So the train derailed, and 154 people were injured, and five people died. Only five. We were very lucky. But that was a very stressful experience, as you can imagine, but certainly a very educational one for me, too.
And you were EMT at that point?
An EMTI, yeah.
EMTI, right, right.
And what year was that?
That was 1984, July 7th.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez, Mike, you might be older than me and Bill. I didn't think that was possible.
Yeah, I have the distinction of being the longest tenured person of my EMS agency. A dubious distinction at best.
Wow.
A great resource.
How many years in EMS then?
I started actually in the spring of 1976, young age of 18. Been involved ever since.
What was it that drew you into it in the first place?
I was one of those many pre-med students that go to college, and I found out that the dormitory I lived in had a lot of people on the rescue squad, and it sounded pretty interesting. So I signed up for what was then the advanced first aid course from the American Red Cross, took that, and was hooked.
And how did you fall into the poison center? Was there just an opening and you said, hey, that sounds interesting?
Yes, yes. It actually was also the communication center for the emergency department in the hospital. So it was a combination of different things. It was a very busy place.
So someone would call in with a poisoned child and you'd look up a reference and then have to put them on hold so you could dispatch an ambulance? Was that what was happening there?
Partly, we'd get calls from a lot of frantic parents of two-year-olds who were exploring their environment by putting everything in their mouths. And then what we'd do is look it up, and rarely was actually an ambulance needed, to my surprise. Fortunately, most of those could be handled at home. Back then, we told a lot of parents to make their kids vomit with syrup of Ipecac, which we have a better idea now. It really isn't very useful.
That is going back.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry if I missed it. Were you a paramedic at the time you went to work at the Poison Control Center?
No, that wasn't until 1994.
Okay.
After I had worked with some people from the Center for Emergency Medicine on several projects, including the 1994 EMT Basic Curriculum Revision, I got to know them there and thought, you know, this is a great opportunity to go to a place that really understands how people learn and has some great clinical facilities. So I did that in 94 and was very happy. I couldn't use my skills here at home. There's a lot of history and even some politics involved there. But I went to Colony, New York for about 5 years, every other weekend or on a 24-hour shift. And that's about a three-hour drive. It's 150 miles. So did that to get some experience. And 3 years ago, actually almost to the day, the area I live in now in Essex, Vermont, actually became paramedic level service along with several other agencies.
And so Vermont's, for our listeners internationally especially, Vermont's a pretty small state in the Northeast or New England. What's EMS like in Vermont? Is it lots of real small volunteer services or sort of a few big services that cover much of the state? Sort of maybe give us a little bit of overview of EMS in Vermont.
Sure. Vermont, you're right, is very small. It's only about 10,000 square miles. I'm not sure what that is in square kilometers. Maybe you can tell me that, Rob. But it has about 600,000 people, which means we have one congressman. We have two senators, but only one congressman. We're just one congressional district. And the largest city is Burlington with not quite 40,000 people, and then drops off fast after that. So most people in Vermont live in small towns. In fact, if you say small Vermont town, you're usually being redundant. But it's a really nice place to live with a great quality of life. And we do have a lot of volunteer ambulance services, although over the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen a migration of all volunteer services moving to combination paid and volunteer, since it's so much harder to get volunteers during the day now.
And Mike, what other post-secondary education did you pursue?
About 10 years ago, I decided to go back to school and went to UVM and got my master's in biostatistics. I got to take my math degree.
You like to take the easy courses.
Yeah.
I'm feeling cerebral overload just hearing the word math and degree and combined in one sentence, side by side?
Well, for me, it was the perfect combination because I got to combine my interest in math with my interest in science and EMS and medicine, and combining those two into doing research and evaluating it for a number of years before I actually became involved directly with it. So a couple of years ago, a position opened up at University of Vermont. We have had a new faculty member, emergency medicine, Colin Freeman, and he's one of those really smart guys, an MD, PhD. So he spends part of his time in the emergency department, but 80% of his time in the lab, and he wanted to start an emergency medicine research program. So he took Judd Hollander's program in Philadelphia and modified that for Vermont. And now we teach undergraduate students to be student research associates, and they staff the emergency department day and night and screening patients for eligibility in the different studies we have. And then we have some more experienced people who come in and get informed consent from the patients after explaining to them what's involved with the different projects.
That's fantastic.
I'm going to interrupt you guys. We're going to take a short break here to hear from our sponsor. I'm also going to try to add Bill Toon, who's dropped off the call during our break, to see if we can get him back on the line. So bear with us for just a moment. Enjoy an ad from our sponsor, and hopefully we'll have Bill when we come back.
This episode of the EMS Educast is sponsored by EMS Manager. They have been consistently helping EMS agencies save time and energy with their innovative web-based software for staff scheduling and management. There's a mobile web app accessible from smartphones or other mobile devices with an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web. You can check your own schedule, and managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere. One Indiana EMS service manager called scheduling a part-time job all by itself, but with EMS Manager, he was able to schedule an entire month of coverage in just a few hours. That's a significant amount of time and money saving for services struggling to make ends meet. It's affordable, too. Pricing for EMS Manager is based on the size of your organization, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud, meaning there is no additional local IT cost to worry about. And there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. If you want this for your system, check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. We would like to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring the EMS Educast and other shows from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and the support of what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes and sign up for the free trial at emsmanager.net. Show them that you appreciate their support by trying out the software. Visit emsmanager.net for LADtech's EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workplace management. Let them know you heard it here on the EMS Educast. emsmanager.net.
So welcome back, everyone. So, Mike, you're just given a brief glimpse into the work that you're doing there with the emergency medicine research. I'm wondering if you can dig into that a little bit more and maybe tell us about some of the research projects that you've been a part of, or some of the training that the students get to be a part of this, especially the undergraduates. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's a very unusual program. We have about 30 students a semester, and we teach them primarily in the first half of the semester about the details of the different projects, inclusion criteria, exclusion criteria, and what basically is going on with the studies. And then in the second half, we go over items like study design, give them an introduction to just a little bit of statistics, some other things. And of course, near the beginning, we cover ethics and informed consent and other important topics like that, too.
And Mike, are these pre-med students?
The vast majority of them are, yeah. Yeah, okay. In fact, we have a number of post-bac pre-med students who take advantage of this, because there are very few ways that a student can actually get patient contact, especially in a research format. And that really looks good on a medical school application. Mm-hmm.
Is there a medical school in Vermont?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, I work for the University of Vermont College of Medicine Department of Surgery, and emergency medicine is a division of the department.
Okay. And is it unusual to have somebody that's trained as a paramedic and has that pre-hospital role? Did you, especially initially, did you sort of find yourself having to explain, you know, how it was that you ended up there?
Yeah, I guess it is a little confusing for the students. You know, I don't have a PhD, so I'm not a doctor or a professor. And so I'm very informal, so I encourage them to call me by my first name, as my boss does too. But it is a little confusing for them because they're used to the professorial type, if I can say that.
Huh. And is there a campus EMS service, or, you know, are many of these pre-med students, do they have any EMT or paramedic training by the time they get into your portion of the program, or are they really on a real traditional, I guess, pre-med route?
Most of them are pretty traditional. Okay. We haven't had any paramedics yet. We've had a few EMTs usually in each class. People who hear about this through word of mouth and think, you know, this might be something good, something to try out.
Huh. One of the things is when I am, say, reading an article in pre-hospital emergency care or something, I'm often struck by, you know, they say our total population was such and such, say 1,000, but because of incomplete patient documentation, you know, we had to throw out 200, or, you know, 200 people weren't included in this study. And I'm always sort of like struck by, like, you know, all the effort that must go into this. And then, you know, right there, you got to, you know, there's a bunch of patients you can't include. And, you know, what sort of like tips or advice would you offer up to both paramedics, but also as well as the educators that are sending them out into the field, of like how to help in the research process by making sure you're actually capturing the necessary information so a patient can be included in the study?
Well, actually, over the last year or two, I've gone out to all the ambulance services in this area and done an introductory session on one of the studies that we're doing that involves EMS. We have a grant from the Department of Defense to look at coagulopathy and trauma, things like disseminated intravascular coagulation and that sort of stuff, things that people, no one knows how to predict, and no one really has a good treatment for, and end up all too often being fatal. So what we're doing is collecting blood samples from trauma patients at hour zero, then 1, 2, 4, 6, up to 5, then less up frequently for up to 5 days. But we're one of only two sites in this study that is collecting blood samples in the field. So we're asking our people when they start IVs to draw some tubes of blood for us. And then they bring that in and we're able to process that. We have a couple of very expensive machines that look at the blood's ability to clot and whether the clot is dissolving, that sort of stuff. And gives you all sorts of thousands of data points and these beautiful curves, but it gets a little complex after that.
So that's interesting. You're just trying to track the timelines of when people start to develop DIC and whether do you delve deeper to see whether most cases of DIC in patients who begin in the pre-hospital setting have a consumptive coagulopathy versus dilutional coagulopathy, or do you not dig that deep?
We haven't gotten to that point yet. At this point, we've only had a couple of patients who've had serious coagulopathies. We had one older woman who ditched her motorcycle, ended up getting over 100 units of blood products. Not units of blood, but blood products, including plasma, and platelets, that sort of thing. But she survived. And we could see on the very first curves, the very first blood sample, that she was having trouble clotting, which was a big surprise because there was no external indication of that whatsoever. But we haven't had a whole lot of patients who have had these serious problems. So we're doing a lot of work and finding mostly normal stuff. But with time, we're sure we'll get some more patients who have some difficulties.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, so with a project like that, as part of your role, teaching the, you know, how to fill the tubes, or is that something that services are already doing? And then, you know, how do you stress to them the importance of not only like accuracy in the blood draw, but also like the other portions of the collection procedure and the labeling and documentation that is probably also very important?
Yeah, when I go out to the different squads, what I do is presentation, and this is for people who are trained to draw blood but who usually don't. The hospital around here, there's only one in the county, traditionally has not been looking for blood samples from the field, though I think that's starting to change. But these are people who are already trained to draw blood, and we ask them to do that on the trauma patients. But when I go out to teach them about this, I try to stress to them the importance of their participation, that they really are vital in our getting these blood samples. And one of the things that I try to do whenever I try to help people understand the importance of research is I try to make it real, giving them pertinent examples. You know, in this area, for instance, over the years, we've done a few studies about starting IVs in ambulances, which back in the 70s or 80s was new for a concept, about the combi tube versus King Airway, and several other things like that, and stress them that their EMS agencies have already been involved with this, and this is really part of a tradition, and they can play an important role in what's going to happen in the future to patients who have these terrible conditions.
That was going to be my follow-up question. Do you think the results of this particular research project that you're working on with EMS will have some implications with fluid resuscitation and when that starts and the volumes or a use of tranexamic acid or other potential treatments in the field?
Yeah, I've been wondering about the tranexamic acid too, hearing more about that. There hasn't been any official talk of that in the field here. The surgeons in this area are still getting used to it. I've only given it a few times, I think. But that's in the back of my mind as perhaps one of the future projects that we might do. We're a long way from that, but certainly I think it might be worth investigating.
I was just thinking, if you're tracking from very early after the onset of trauma, after the incident, the whole clotting cascade, I would think that would tie in quite nicely with whatever therapies that happen outside of the hospital as well.
Yeah, we actually, one of the principal investigators for this project is Dr. Ken Mann. He's a biochemist, and he's one of the world's experts on hemophilia and blood clotting. He has, if you look him up in PubMed, he has over 400 articles to his name. And he's at retirement age now, so I figure it's about a paper a month that he was publishing. But he knows a lot about this. And so he's been one of the guiding forces behind this project. And the idea is that they're going to do just about every test known to modern chemistry on this blood to see what they can use when they throw it all into a computer with a systems biology approach and see what comes out as perhaps predictive factors that might help us in the future.
Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I'm just curious, like, what kind of trauma would somebody have to be included in this study? Is it is there some parameters around there that you're giving the paramedics?
Yep. It's only people over 18, okay. So we don't include minors. And also, it's someone who does not have any pre-existing clotting problems. So known with hemophilia or Leiden factor 5, that sort of stuff. No one on anticoagulants either. It's really wouldn't be able to learn much from them. But we have a waiver of initial consent from our institutional review board. And so I've been teaching the providers that they don't have to worry about getting consent. In fact, if they tried, it wouldn't be truly informed consent because of the stress that the patient is undergoing. So we're allowed to collect the blood samples, and then within 24 hours, usually the next morning at rounds in the intensive care unit, one of the attending surgeons will try to get consent from the patient or from a member of the family. So, and then that continues for up to 30 days if we're not able to. So far, we've been able to get consent from just about everybody, with only very few exceptions.
And what kind of a sample size are you looking to get? How many patients are you hoping to enroll?
I believe it's 250. It's been a while since I looked at that, and there's been talk about expanding it. We're waiting to hear about another grant application from the National Institutes of Health, but that would allow us to expand this project and be the coordinating center for, I think, 11 different sites around the country doing this and more. So it's very exciting.
So prior to this research project involving these paramedics, had they been exposed to research before? Had they been involved in research before?
Not much. A little bit. We did a study a few years ago when we started doing 12 leads by EMTs and EMTIs, which was all we had then, and found that when we went from radio to cell phone, we had about a 20% improvement in the legibility, in the percentage of legible tracings that were received. So that was one project. So whenever they did a 12 lead, one of our students would greet them in the emergency department and get information from them. We also did a comparison of the Combi tube and the King Airway, and they were filling out data sheets for that. So we started off easy, I think, in introducing people to the concept of EMS research. And over time, we've increased the amount of participation, and we're hoping to increase that even more. We're looking right now at a project we're just about to submit to our IRB for use of a cooling collar for patients resuscitated after cardiac arrest but who haven't regained consciousness.
Okay. So is that a particular – is that a product, a private company product of some sort?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah,
the Excel Cryo Cooling Collar is the name, I believe.
Okay.
Do you end up having – with just 600,000 people in the state, do you have to like – is your potential population for patients the entire state just to be able to include enough patients in the study?
It has been difficult to get patients.
Yeah.
The area, the catchment area for Fletcher Allen Healthcare, the name of the hospital here, includes upstate New York and even a little bit of northern New Hampshire. So it's a larger area than you might think. And it is probably about 300,000 people altogether, I think, not all of whom are in Vermont by any means. But it is difficult. You know, you're talking before about the kinds of trauma. It's pretty unusual to see penetrating trauma here.
Right.
Blunt trauma is by far the more common kind that we see here.
Yeah, I suppose once hunting season picks up, you might get a few more self-inflicted hunter injuries or hunters out of tree stands like we get here in Wisconsin. But
yes, yes. Sometimes the emergency department staff will put up a scorecard and hunting season begins, you know, put up how many deer versus how many hunters.
Right. Yeah.
So, Mike, one of the interests of this show is teaching research to EMS providers and generating enthusiasm around research and even just simply helping EMS providers become information literate. In your work with this group doing this DIC study, have you found sort of increase in enthusiasm and people wanting to do more, learn more about research and get more actively involved with the research team?
Yes, yes. A few people, not a whole lot. Most people have pretty busy lives and aren't able to participate as much as they might like. But I've had several people approach me about potential projects that we are looking at perhaps doing. So it is nice to see people taking this seriously and seeing that it does have value, that even though a patient the EMT might treat at that moment may not benefit from the study, there are other people in the future who might stand to benefit a great deal from it.
And have you seen any increase in interest in, say, workshops or presentations to services to help them get a better understanding of the different types of studies that go on and could be done in the out-of-hospital setting?
I think so. Yeah, I've done a presentation at the Vermont EMS conference for a number of years where I review the research that was published in the previous year or so and try to show people, above all, how important it is to be skeptical, that you can't just accept an author's claims as being true, as being correct. Not necessarily through fraud or anything like that, but people have their own biases. And we just need to be aware of those and let the data speak for itself and make sure that any claims that are made can actually be supported by the data.
I'm just thinking we need someone to create a skeptical paramedic blog. And you might be the guy to do that, Mike.
I just think the rogue medic, you know, blog is a lot of skepticism there.
Yeah, for sure. Because there's a Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine by Dr. Ken Milne. That's a podcast, a great podcast. And there's a Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I think we need a Skeptic's Guide to out-of-hospital medicine or transport medicine or something.
Mike, yeah. With the Vermont EMS conference just around the corner, is there one or two studies that you're already looking at that recently that you're going to feature?
To report at the conference?
Yes, mean? Yeah, yeah.
Not specifically, no. We're actually just about to – we just saw the proofs for our 12-lead EKG paper, so that'll be out in print very soon. But that is really just this area, not the entire state.
All right.
What I try to do is give people examples of stuff that was in different journals and say, well, this is reasonable, but look at how they claim that this is true. But when you look at the data, it really doesn't support that claim.
What are some of the examples?
Let's see.
I'm putting you on the spot here, but if something yep. comes to mind.
Well, I made a list when after you called me. So,
okay.
Remember a couple of years ago, we were taught that you should do CPR for 2 minutes before defibrillating someone, even if they dropped in front of you?
Yeah.
That was based all on before and after studies, whereas when someone did a review of all the randomized control trials, which is a better quality trial, they found that there was no difference. No difference whatsoever. And so the only time to do CPR before defibrillation is as you're getting the machine out and getting it set up. There's no good reason to delay defibrillation. But there were a number of people who claimed, based on their studies, that you should delay defibrillation. And that just has not been borne out.
Mm-hmm. We've been looking at that with the Resuscitation Outcome Consortium, upfront CPR, early defib, 10 to 1 ventilations, 30 to 2 ventilations, all of that stuff. So it'll be interesting to see the outcome of those trials.
Yeah, people are pretty shocked when I tell them that the rates and ratios of CPR have never been validated. That was just some people's best idea of what would work. But no one ever evaluated that before it was put into the guidelines.
Yeah. So I want to jump in here for a second. If you were, and Rob touched on this, and I'm not sure if you really covered it, if I'm an EMS instructor, what would you recommend to an EMS instructor is the best way or resources or concepts to start getting their students, and it can be done, I don't care if we're talking the EMR, the EMT, paramedic level, to begin to get them to understand a little bit something about research, but not only their role as a participant in it in the future, but how they could utilize it themselves in their practice and maybe influence and move their organization more to an evidence base.
This is where instructors, I think, have a vital role. Obviously, they do in many ways, but I think especially in the area of research, partly because it is such a new area. And I think it's really important for instructors to bring to their students, both initial and continuing education students, pertinent examples of things. My favorite example being about removal of the bee stinger. There was a nice study in 1996 where some entomologists, a little crazy entomologists from Berkeley, let themselves be stung
aren't
by
they
bees.
All crazy?
Yeah. Let themselves be stung by bees for 1, 2, 4, 8 seconds in different arms and that sort of thing, and tried different ways of removing it. Found it really didn't make any difference how you got it out. It was just how fast you got it out. And
really?
That whole concept of the floppy bag of venom is incorrect. In fact, the bee stinger is like a hard box with a little piston in it that's pumping venom into the wound as long as it's embedded there. So just pulling it out, no matter what you have to hand to do it with, is the best thing to do. But trying to get people to understand that is a little difficult because it goes against what they were taught. And then, you know, I ask them, I point out that you really should change practice after something's been replicated, because one study itself is really not something to hang your hat on usually. So I say, well, what science do you think the current recommendations are based on? And then I tell them there's absolutely no science behind it. It was someone's good idea. So these entomologists have given us the first hard science of what is a really small thing, but has big implications when you try to implement that. You know, how do you do that with, how do you make sure that the correct answer on the National Registry exam is going to be the current one? What about textbooks? You know, all sorts of things like that. Little things can have big ripples. But besides, whoop, what?
Don't get Bill started on textbooks.
But about
10 years
things,
out of date.
I do, besides bring up pertinent examples, is I encourage instructors to de-emphasize the statistics. And this is coming from a statistician, because that turns people off. I love it, but I know most people don't. They think it should be pronounced statistics. So I encourage them, just leave it out as much as you can, and instead encourage skepticism. And then also, don't just teach one class on research. Try to bring it up when you have different topics like shock. And someone says, well, what about the classes of shock? And then the instructor can point out, there's absolutely no science behind that whatsoever. That was just someone's good idea. And what really surprises people sometimes, that there's some pretty good science now, that hypotensive hemorrhagic patients don't get a pulse rate over 90 or 130% of the time. And that's been consistent, not just with wounds that might cause a vagal reaction, but with extremity wounds. And it's been in a number of studies now.
And these are patients who aren't on beta blockers or calcium channel blockers. That's what you're
saying?
Right.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
These people didn't read the book.
Right.
And so it's a little difficult for students to understand that. And one of the things I think instructors need to do is to help them understand how our knowledge base is changing. One of the best instructors I know tells his students in the first class, half of what I tell you is wrong. The only problem is I can't tell you which half. Because things are going to be changing.
As true as that might be, I would never advocate that as a way to start out your.
Well, he's very self-deprecating.
I mentioned at the start, I was at this World Trauma Symposium last week, and there was a lot of talk about tourniquets, and two different presenters suggested that tourniquets should be. And especially, I think their reference was the United States, where we just have so much more penetrating trauma of, you know, tourniquets should be as widely distributed and as available to the public as AEDs are. And, I was really struck by that, partly just because, you know, it came up twice. And then I sort of just imagined all the people that make tourniquets, like giving each other high fives in the back of the room. And so I was very skeptical and even expressed that in the meeting, but how would you make a study or research to help decide that question of like, yes, we should do that or no, we shouldn't?
Ooh, that's a tall order.
I'm thinking that's you want to look at the epidemiology to start with. How frequently does someone sustain a wound that would benefit from a tourniquet, and if the numbers are extraordinarily low, which is, I suspect they are, despite the high incidence of penetrating trauma in the United States, then why? How can you advocate for making them as widespread as something else? You know, like an AED. That would be my first question.
Yeah, I think you're right. The first thing you got to do is figure out, do you have enough of a sample size to even do the study? And I think you're right, it would be very difficult. Maybe a few particular areas in urban areas in particular could support that. But it's something that should not just be assumed, like AEDs. There's now been there have been two studies where they gave AEDs to family members of high-risk cardiac patients and found that it did not improve survival, much to everyone's astonishment, or at least some people's astonishment. So we can't just assume that putting these things where they presumably are needed is going to result in a better outcome. It's not just the device. It's also the system that puts that device into action that needs to be taken paid attention to.
Right. Well, that'll be just an auxiliary piece of equipment to your iPhone in the not-too-distant future. So,
the AED or the tourniquet?
The AED, sorry. Yeah. So.
Yeah. That will come along with your video laryngoscope.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. So when I raised that, and that was my take on it too, Rob, was like, well, what's the frequency of extremity trauma that can't be controlled by other means that would require a tourniquet compared to sudden cardiac arrest? And, the pushback was, well, we don't know, but that shouldn't stop us. And then the next part of it was like, well, these are so cheap compared to the cost of the AED. Why not just throw a tourniquet into the cabinet with every AED? And then the more nuanced response was, well, you know, these sort of high risk places, and they brought up, well, maybe in the principal's office at the school there should be a bag full of tourniquets, and police officers should all be carrying tourniquets, and
Well, it's like that expression, you know, if you bring a hammer to the party, everything looks like a nail. And I worry that, you know, if people have tourniquets everywhere, the first thing they're going to do is put a tourniquet on instead of, you know, when all it needs is a 4x4 and some light pressure.
Right.
Yep. Now I do need to interrupt in there, Greg, because we had a crew that had a gentleman with his arm caught in a big track device, and he knew it was pretty mangled, so the crew was able to expose the upper arm, and they were going to place a tourniquet, and they the guy limited space, and he calls down and he says, toss me up a tourniquet. Well, he ended up with about 8 of them tossed at him, because almost every police officer on the scene had one with him, and they all started tossing him at the same time.
Jeez.
But like we have it. Well, it's in this area here, a lot of our police officers, and it's nothing formal, have started carrying the combat application tourniquet. And we've had two cases here in the last, since the first of the year. Well, one case for sure where a police officer entered a resident where it turned out to be a homicide-suicide type situation, but actually the gentleman was unsuccessful in shooting his significant other, but the police officer came in, it was an unsafe situation, applied the tourniquet, and then dragged the person, you know, out of the location and stuff like that. And there's a little question, you know, from the trauma surgeon's point of view, the benefit that it happened. So, but we've had, maybe since we've really put tourniquets in place, we've had probably about, I would say, not more than a half a dozen applications at this point, you know, within our system.
And that's a high volume system, isn't it?
I don't think we're that busy. Maybe we run about 36,000 calls a year or so.
Okay. By Vermont standards, that's very high volume.
Well, come on, you can't compare things to Vermont. Vermont's beautiful. You know, people don't get hurt in Vermont.
What about that the King versus the Combi Tube study? You know, how was that set up, and was there an education component to, say, teaching people how to use the King or something before the study started?
Yeah, what happened was that the Combi Tube was part of the EMT intermediate curriculum in Vermont, and then the King Airway came along. It hadn't existed, I think, when we started that program. And the EMS medical advisor for Fletcher Allen was interested in changing to this, and he had read some very encouraging things and thought that this might improve our success rate. So we did consistent training by a limited number of people to all the services in the area. And then also they had to fill out data sheets each time they used them. So that by the end, I wasn't surprised, but he was, when the success rate was about the same, somewhere between 75 and 80%.
And how did you define success?
Yes. That was being able to ventilate. When possible, we asked attending physicians to verify it, but that often didn't happen. But at least they could tell us that they saw the chest rising when it was being used as the patient was brought in. But that's always a big question. How do you define these endpoints in research studies?
Do you ever, I just have one final question. That's, do you ever like take a look at like how effective the education is? You know, say that the effectiveness of the education to use the King as part of the larger project to compare the success with the King versus the CombiTube?
I'm not quite sure what you mean, Greg.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about like researching EMS education, like the educational process itself, rather than some clinical procedure.
Yeah, that's an area that really is just is very fertile with possibilities. I've been involved with one project where we looked at some hybrid learning, including some online learning with a particular subject. And we found that it did seem to improve people's performance on tests. That was done as continuing education. But there are a lot of things we do in EMS that have not been evaluated. And it's hard to do good educational research, but it's very important, too. It can really make a big difference in the future.
I still can't get over.
Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say, I think that that is, as Mike says there, I think that that's a key thing is if I think we have to figure out, no matter what is the most effective way to get training rolled out, particularly on new procedures, particularly if they're considered life-saving procedures. It's interesting, even in the Rock did a thing about this where it showed that there was a range of somewhere between about, and don't quote me, between 400 to up to 750 days before they could implement a change like in the CPR when guidelines changed and stuff. And these are sites that are a little bit more geared towards the training. And some of the aspects of it is the inability of the instructors to even be up to speed to deliver the material. So I think there's a really big area there is we've got to probably help nail that down is what are some of the most effective ways to not only deliver the stuff, but also how well does it stay with someone and do they retain it?
Well put.
Rob, do you have something additional to add before we start a wrap up here?
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the whole removal of the bee stinger thing. Now that, you know, I'm still experiencing some cognitive dissonance here. So I love that. That was awesome.
Excellent.
I'll email you the reference.
Yeah, we'll post that in our show notes. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. The you know, Mike, before we move into the endorsements section of the show, do you have a final thought or anything additional you'd like to share with us about your work and emergency medicine research?
Sure. Just two quick things. One is that when I go out to show people what kind of research we're doing and ask them to participate, I give the EMS people a copy of a list of questions they should ask of anyone who invites them to participate in research, things like informed consent and benefits and risks, that sort of thing, because that's really important. That's, I think, one of the most important things we can stress to them, that research is good, but you got to do it right and you got to do it ethically. And so having this list of questions should be very helpful for them. The other thing is it's easy to discourage people when you start telling them that half of what they were taught was wrong. And so I try to end every session about this stuff by telling them that it's not all bad, that there's a lot of good stuff. We should use science when we have it to give the best care possible. When we don't have it, then we have to go back on our best judgment. And in both cases, both science and judgment, there are going to be disagreements. The important thing is to do what you think is best for the patient and to be skeptical about anyone's claims about new information or products, that sort of thing.
I like the nod to skepticism.
Especially about products.
Yeah. Yeah. You need one of these widgets.
No ulterior motives there.
Right. Well, listeners, thanks for bearing with us. A couple technical problems here that we've worked through. I think, Mike, if a listener wants to connect with you and learn more about the work you're doing, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Probably my work email address, which is mokeefe@uvm.edu.
All right.
And don't forget, you're going to start a blog called The Skeptical Paramedic, right?
I'll think about that.
Well, we like to wrap up the show with an endorsement or a recommendation or something we want to make sure. Maybe it's an app or a piece of software, a book, an event, something we want to make sure other EMS educators know about. And I'll go first so everybody can make sure they have something excellent prepared. Last week at EMS World Expo, I attended the U.S. premiere of the movie Paramedico. It was a film by Benjamin Gilmore. He's also written a book by the same name, Paramedico, Around the World by Ambulance, which is sitting here on my desk, which I hope to read real soon. The film was a film that Ben recorded. He said he's been to 13 different sites and ridden along as a paramedic. The film featured four sites, Honolulu, Venice. Why am I blanking on this right now? Honolulu, Venice, Mexico City, and some big city in Pakistan. And Ben, I apologize, I can't remember the city. It was 55 minutes. It was an amazing film. Ben's just really done something just terrific for paramedics, and I really admire just both the work as well as the risk he took, watching some of the, especially in Pakistan and Mexico City, the film is the ambulance screamed through the streets or even ran out of gas, and some of the scenes that he was present at, my hands and feet were sweating, just imagining sort of the level of tension and danger in those places. And so check out Paramedico. You can find the book in the Amazon store, or the movie is available for purchase and download on Ben's website, and we'll put the link in the show notes.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's great.
I was looking for the movie in iTunes. The book's available there, but I don't see the movie there. So
It'd be a good activity, Rob. You could watch it with your class one afternoon. Mm-hmm. Maybe
I'm thinking that. Yeah,
holiday
when
break.
when I want to put my feet up.
And bring Ben in by Skype. He's an awesome guy.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what's your recommendation, Rob?
I'm enrolled in another Coursera massive open online course, a MOOC. It's called Foundations of Virtual Instruction, and it starts September 30th. And so even if you're hearing this message late, a number of people enroll in these free online courses late and can still finish it because they're not too difficult. And the focus is, so it's called Foundations of Virtual Instruction from a professor from UC Irvine. And it's geared to the K-12 environment, but I think it has some overreaching topics that are relevant to anyone teaching in the post-secondary education field and the EMS field. So now I haven't taken the course, so I can't say firsthand what it's like, but I've heard from a couple of people taking it said it was very informative and quite good. So that's my recommendation.
Excellent. You'll have to let us know how that goes. And Mike, what's your recommendation, something you want to share with EMS educators around the world?
There's a book I read that I recommend very highly called How Doctors Think by Jerome Gropman, I think is the name of the author. And it goes over a lot about differential diagnosis, but also about the biases and heuristics that anyone who's going to be making patient care decisions needs to be aware of. And this is especially true for instructors who are guiding students at the beginning stages. And they can really make a big difference by helping the students to understand how they're thinking with these things. And I'll just end with one little quote. It's easy to lie with statistics, but it's easier to lie without them.
There you go. Bill, are you still with us, and do you have something to recommend this week?
I'm still with you, and I have no recommendations this week. I'll have to pass.
Okay, well, I'll fill that little void in the show by saying I really appreciated the number of listeners that came up to me at EMS World Expo and introduced themselves and shared how much they enjoy listening to the show. It actually happened, Rob, I was asked one of my questions at World Trauma Symposium as we walked out the door to go to lunch. A guy walked up next to me and said, "Your voice is very familiar. I'm wondering where I've heard your voice before." I said, "Well, I talk a lot." And he said, "Well, yeah, that could be it." And I said, "Well, I do a podcast." He's like, "Oh, the EMS Educast. Where's Rob? Where's Bill?" And, you know, and then a few minutes later, another guy walked up to me. He's like, "Oh, I just saw your name tag after you stood up." And I'm like, "I listened to the show, and thank you guys." The one was a listener from New Zealand. The first guy was from New Zealand, and he shared that we have a big audience in New Zealand, that we have a lot of listeners there.
Really?
And I shared with him that all of us would love to visit New Zealand someday.
I love those guys.
Yeah, so
that is so awesome.
Hopefully maybe we can connect with him, and maybe we can find somebody to be on the show from New Zealand again.
And it's one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Yeah.
It's absolutely gorgeous there.
Sounds wonderful. So, thank you to everybody that not only said hello, but that you continue to listen to and share the show. We appreciate it greatly. Mike, thanks so much on behalf of Rob Theriault and Bill Toon. This is Greg Freese for the EMS Educast.